Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Students around the world are asking questions about God, the truth, and the meaning of their lives. Your gift will put top-notch Catholic intellectuals in front of students who are seeking. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students to transform a student's life today. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students.
I have a little proposal, and then Sister and I are going to chat through, and then we're going to open it up to questions, and then we're going to open it up to more questions. And then Jesus is going to invite us into a life of questioning, and then we're going to die. So I thought that we could just start with a couple of offenses, just to have a sampling, and that way we can identify common themes or like common realities at stake in said offenses. And then we can examine what is it about those offenses which causes anger. And then in what way is anger in the service of, one, the rectification of the injustice, and then two, the reconciliation of the wounded individual with the wounder, that is to say, the kind of pardon, forgiveness, reconciliation to be had in the relationship. Okay, so some instances of simple offenses, because I think that it's easier to reason upon simple offenses before we reason upon complex offenses. Let's say that you and your roommate live in an apartment, and that your roommate comes kind of charging out of the restroom with a full head of steam and says, "What the heck? I told you 100 times not to, leave the toilet paper dispenser empty." Okay, so that's the thing that's been done. Now, it just so happens that, yes, you have quite a few times left the toilet paper dispenser empty for various reasons, and you had excuses in your mind for each of those instances. But on this particular instance, you and your roommate had a guest visiting the past couple of days, and what you suspected was actually the guest who exhausted the toilet paper from the toilet paper roll. And so it wasn't you. All right, so there's a past history of you having been unjust. But in this case, it wasn't you. And on account of the fact that the friend was common to you and to the other, that your roommate didn't think of that as a possibility, it hurts you, because your roommate just assumes, given the past history and given the judgments that your roommate has made about you, that you are the offender, that you don't think of your roommate when it comes to the replenishment of toilet paper. Okay? All right, let's say that you receive an invitation from your friend to a party, okay? For a helpful backstory, let's say that you're a very talented DJ, okay? And you receive an invitation from your friend to a party, and, he's describing it, and you're like, "Yeah, that sounds great, ready to go." Now, you're a person who typically shows up about 15 to 20 minutes late, so as to afford your host ample time for preparation, just in case something goes wrong. It's just kind of common courtesy. But in this instance, your friend insists that you show up a little bit early. Like, wow, weird. I don't know the last time I've ever been early for a party. And when you show up, right, you see there's like a little kind of sound system there in the corner with an aux cord, and there's nothing attached to the aux cord. And then your friend turns to you and says, "Oh, looks like they haven't curated the music for tonight. Would you have any interest?" And you say, "Wait a second. I feel like I just got invited to a party to DJ it. That's different than being invited to a party." And so you feel offended, because you feel like your friend just used you for your excellence in disc jockeying arts. So let's say another kind of simple thing. Let's say that you are going back and forth with your friend about plans for the evening, and that at a certain point you propose something concrete. And ordinarily, your friend responds to you within 30 minutes to an hour. But in this instance, your friend hasn't responded to you over the course of a whole day. And the plans are actually for tonight. And it's getting closer and closer. And you're in that awkward position where you're like, do I send another text message and seem needy? Or do I make a phone call and seem like a millennial? Or do I show up at the house and seem like a stalker? Right, but then you say, I'm just going to trust that this relationship is what I think it is. And as it turns out, another 5 hours elapses, and your friend says, oh, so sorry, didn't see your text message. It won't work for tonight. Okay? So what exactly is at stake in each of these offenses? I pick silly offenses because we're all offended at silly things, right? So what's exactly at stake in each of these offenses? The proposal that I made last night was that we've kind of dropped out of mind and heart, right? That the other has failed to hold us in mind and heart. And I think part of it, too, is that to be held in mind and heart is for the other to have access to my interior life and to cherish that. And so the other has failed to access my interior life, or has chosen not to access my interior life, or has chosen not to abide with me in my interior life. Like, I've just been seen as a toilet paper roll exhauster offender, right? Or I have just been seen as a DJ. Or I have just been seen as one who could take up 4 hours of my night in a less than optimally pleasant way. Because truth be told, I prefer to be alone on the couch watching previews of Netflix shows. So then, what then does the manifestation and communication of anger serve within this setting? I think what it does is that it's willing to hold a wound open, and it's willing to expose a wound to another in order to show that I have been wounded. And I think that when you do that, you're showing the other, on the one hand, I'm asking God to heal this wound, but on the other hand, I'm asking you to cooperate with God in the healing of this wound. I am asking at the very least that this be acknowledged. I don't know if you're capable of cooperating with God in the healing of this wound, but at the very least, I want this relationship to be humanized, because I feel like at some level, I've been dehumanized. And so when I do that, I think that my anger, it helps to elicit contrition. Because when St. Thomasino talks about anger, it's for punishment, right? But when punishment is interiorized by the other party, when she takes it as her own, her task, you know, like her blessed burden, then it becomes something different. It becomes contrition or satisfaction, you know, like those are but the same thing. But I interiorize whatever this is, you know, like as you described it, Father Gregory, I interiorize this thing and I make it my own as a gesture of love, right? As a gesture of hope and reconciliation, but of genuine, like, effort, as it were, to do something so as to fill up what is lacking at present. So that's just a simple proposal. But we had talked about other things in which you're interested, other things that can help to fill in the gaps, I suppose, of some of these descriptions. But I don't know if there's a particular place from which you'd like to launch.
A distinction.
Yeah.
The title of this conversation. Isn't that curious that you have a title for a conversation? it seems like it's ambiguous. So anger ad salutem. So roughly, we have anger and we have healing. And I think there are two different directions that perhaps we can take both of them, but I'd like to be clear on which one we're taking in. My sense from your introduction is that what we're heading for is an account of how can anger bring about healing.
Yep.
Sorry. That's different from something that I think is related, but also of interest, at least to me, and I think to anyone who might be listening, is how can we bring about the healing of anger that is not what it ought to be?
Mm.
So I think before pursuing either of those, it might be helpful to get at some sense of what it means to be healed.
Sure.
And I think that healing is going to be different in either of those circumstances. So just starting with how can anger bring about healing? That was, you know, really what you outlined. It seems like, okay, well, what is it? Maybe we can start by saying, what is it that needs to be healed? From your outline, I was, as you saw, taking notes. is an offense something that really needs to be healed? What are the parts of an offense, you know, if we had to break it into parts? there's the pain. And sometimes it's some sort of, sometimes the pain is different from the judgment that I should not be in pain. Sometimes, you know, the judgment that I should not be in pain actually increases the pain. So it's hard to, you know, sit this out experientially. But it seems like in the, take the DJ example, or the misuse of my sick DJ talents. That really was about me. there is, on the one hand, you can see the pain. Say I kind of reflect. Say I'm the sullen, stewing sort. Suppose it's after the night. Suppose I don't really realize what's happening, so I end up DJing. And as it's happening, there's something that's wrong, but I don't quite know what's wrong. And it's only after I go home and have a mildly sleepless night, and then wake up the next morning, go for a run. It's only after I've gone for a run that I start to realize, wait a second, I know why I'm angry. So in other words, sometimes how we've been offended takes a while to manifest itself. So suppose at that point I say, at that point when I realize that was so unfair, that was manipulative. He was just using me. His perception of my who I am and what I am, his perception of my identity, that reduced me to just my DJ ability. So perhaps it takes me a while to make a judgment of exactly why that was wrong. Now, this is kind of the judgments that are going through my head that make me register this as an offense and not merely just something not right, not merely just a pain. That takes a while. But even before that point, I would have experienced the pain of kind of lost time. And that's not a great pain. It's like there's on a very raw level, we can recognize I'm in pain even before we register exactly the quality of that pain. So kind of stepping back and saying, what is it in an offense that needs to be healed? There's on the one hand, the pain. And on the other hand, the judgment the injustice, because I think everything at which we get angry comes down to those two things, pain and then the judgment that this was unjust. And it seems to me like the healing, maybe both of those could be healed, but I don't think the healing of pain happens in the same way that the healing of injustice is healed. Seems to me like the healing of injustice, this is where we're going to connect back to the question that you started with. The healing of injustice, I think, takes place through anger, but ordered anger, not disordered anger. I'm deliberately using those words rather than virtuous because I don't really know what it means to be virtuous.
Nice. Okay, so some initial thoughts. I think that apropos of your first comment, that the healing of anger is instrumental to the healing of the relationship.
Yeah.
So I think that
specifically the injustice aspect.
Yep.
So that the relationship that has been somehow torn asunder or punctured by an isolated act that is unjust.
And I think that part of the healing of it, so you describe pain and then the judgment rendered upon the pain. I think that part of what we're responsible for are a series of judgments regarding the nature of the pain. And I think that this is part of where sorting out amongst our emotional responses is helpful. Like my little nieces and nephews, you know, they went to this little session with somebody who explained to them, like, you're in blue right now, or you're in yellow right now, or you're in red right now, to help them process their emotion by colors. I don't remember what it's called, like color therapy, so that they would have the vocabulary. Yeah, exactly. I abide in red. That way they would have the vocabulary to describe the frustration rather than just saying, like, my back hurts, or rather than just saying, I don't want to go to school. They'd have some more language. They'd have some vocabulary and grammar for describing the source of their discomfort. And I think that because we've described that anger is often at the nexus of a variety of emotional responses, or a kind of coming together of various emotional responses, we've identified hatred, we've identified sorrow, we've identified hope, just to begin. But I suspect that it's like more complex than just 11 emotions, each kind of like ka-chunka, ka-chunka, ka-chunka. You know, there's various things that are going on there, which are which are more complex. I think that part of what we're responsible for is experiencing the pain with a kind of innocence, but then sorting out about what's concerned, because we bring our wounded selves to every interaction. And those wounds pre-exist our relationships and the wounds then dealt within the setting of those relationships. And we can't make other people responsible for our whole wounded past, right? But that's part of the story. So we have to have some critical consciousness of it, even whilst admitting that we remain somewhat mysterious to ourselves. So I think that it requires of us to do a little bit of the work of sorting out amongst our different emotional responses, and then purifying the judgments which we render thereupon as to who's to blame, in what way, and then the course to be pursued. So that way, it's not like we're going to rarefy the anger, but we're going to kind of identify appropriately, and then purify the anger such that in communicating it, we communicate it as it's meant to be communicated, not as anger within a complex tangle of hatred, sorrow, hope, and whatever else is at stake. I think that's part of like healing anger being instrumental to, and in my understanding, instrumental to, I always think of the sacred humanity of Christ. So I don't think instrumental in the bad sense of setting aside. I think of the called up into and thereby participating in the work of, that it's instrumental to the healing of the relationship. I don't know what you think about that.
Can I start by bringing us back to the notion of does pain need healing?
Sure.
And so setting aside, I used a phrase that I'm not quite sure what it means, the purification of anger, so I'm going to set that aside and go back to, does pain need healing?
Can I say one thing about the purification of anger?
Yeah.
I identify, like, anger, it naturally tends in an impure direction. And I think one of the ways that we register that is ideation. Because kind of like...
Wait. What's impure?
Impure in the sense of it turns black. So I'm gonna, in the sense that like... When...
I don't speak your color language.
So like when anger is locked up within an individual, and when he or she, you know, perseverates on it, cogitates upon it, it has a kind of tendency to devolve into like a fell ideation of you picture yourself before the other exacting vengeance rather than vindication. Is just, I'm just like taking literary examples. I'm not like thinking too terribly much about the examples that I just cited. But if you don't find an expression for anger, or if you don't begin to do the work of identifying what plays into it and then the judgments rendered upon it, my sense is that it tends to putrefy. If you disagree, say I disagree.
I disagree with, but I'm not sure with what.
Okay.
It's just this. I want to make a space for the possibility of virtuous anger, meaning it would be better for you to get angry than for you not. I think Thomas has a place for that, and Christ cleansing the temple has a place for that. But it's not only Christ, and I think we can sometimes look at the incident of the cleansing of the temple and say, oh yeah, but that was Christ. For the rest of us, anger always turns black. And I don't want to say that. And I'm not saying that either. Okay.
Yeah. I'm just saying that's the general tendency of an emotion unreconciled, like unrectified and unreconciled, trapped up within a human heart.
Okay, trapped up.
Yeah.
Except it seems to me like the natural trajectory of anger is not to remain trapped up. It is, and that's where I fall back on my beloved prepositions of anger is on account of something at you for that. So there's an other directedness of anger. Anger turns black if you're trapped up.
Which I think a lot of people do.
Oh, sure.
So I'm just saying.
But I don't think if you say what's the natural tendency of anger, I'm taking natural as what is the good, what's the proper work.
Sure,
anger.
I was
proper
using
work of anger
natural.
Is to say, I want to make, in your words, I'm going to make vulnerable. I'm going to expose the wound in me. I'm going to expose that to you. And I don't even know what I'm going to do after I expose it, but at least I'm not going to hold it in. So I would say there's a place for regarding red anger as good. I maybe completely forget about pain.
That's good.
but I want to go back there.
Yeah, no doubt you do. But I think that the nature of that differentiation, or excuse me, the nature of our difference on that point is just that when I said natural, I meant fallen natural.
Okay,
so I'm talking about like the principle that works itself out in human nature inexorably in time and space is original sin. That's the only one that we can rely upon to just do its work without any babysitting.
Okay, I love the word work.
Yeah,
okay. And I would say with the proper work, the good work.
Yeah.
Or even, you don't even need to say proper or good. It's that, what's the work of anger? The work of anger is to externalize what I have registered, perhaps even not with great rationality, internally.
Yeah.
But then the work of anger, when it's doing its work well, is I have experienced pain. I've come to understand that pain as an injustice, and I've done so rationally. And now I am exposing that to you, that reality. You know, the good anger is always, in human beings, is always going to use words. So again, that's a kind of externalization. So inviting you in to help figure out how can we heal this injustice. Back to pain. You okay with that?
What's it?
Can we go back to pain?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. It seems to me like what we, when we experience something, let's call it, let's take an example, just a physical pain, which is not one of the three that you proposed. So it's not the toilet paper, it's not the DJ, and it's not the just being neglected. Suppose it's just some, you have a raging fever. And so since you have a fever, you also are kind of prevented from even the ability to make sense of it. But even if you did have the possession of your, you know, your full faculties, making sense of it, that's to say putting judgments around it, still doesn't take away the pain. Does the physical pain, just the achiness and whatever, does that require healing? My sense is, okay, I like to do this with layers of words. I don't really know what it means to be healed. But here's what my sense is that we all want when we're in pain. We want someone to be with us in our pain. Even if that's also a very frightening notion, if you're really in pain, you realize that, okay, well, I could distract myself from it, but to what end? And oftentimes, in order to, because we can't, because no one else is there with us in our pain, we then resort to making judgments in order to distract ourselves from it. So if we're really going to be in pain and not just run away, ultimately what that requires is that someone is there with us. Not to offer explanations, but just to be with us. Incidentally, there was a question after, I think, your talk yesterday about Our Lady of Sorrows. And I think this is what the Blessed Virgin Mary does so beautifully, is that she experiences a pain and she doesn't run away from it. She lets herself be pierced by a sword. And why can she do that? Well, because she doesn't have to bother trying to defend herself. She's not trying to pull the sword out. Why? Because she's confident in the love of God the Father, Holy Spirit, and perhaps she has some sense of God the Son in her womb. So why can she stabat mater? Why can she stand at the foot of the cross? Because she's learned. She's been taught divinely how to just be there in pain and not run away. Because she recognizes, I can stand here because there's someone else here. There's someone else with me. So I think, all right, when we are in pain, what is it that's going to deliver us from all the frenzy of things that we do?
Can I push pause for a second?
Yeah.
Respond to a couple of things before you keep. What you described with respect to, okay, so you want somebody to be within your pain, that resonates, or that corresponds to my experience. I was at Seek, whatever, last week, the week before, and you made reference to the fever. You were sick, I was sick, but we were in different places. I was like sicker than I've been in living memory, maybe the sickest I've ever been. And it was like, I went to bed on Tuesday night at 8:30 p.m. to try to beat the sickness, and I didn't fall asleep until 4:30 in the morning. So like round about 1:15, I was in my bed as like little tears streamed from my eyes. And I was like, Jesus, what does this mean? And what I heard back was precisely nothing. And I was like, cool, what a blessing. Right? But I think that, so like what's fascinating, it seems to me, about the manifestation and communication of anger to the very party by whom you seemingly were offended, which in that case, it's like, Lord, in your loving kindness, Lord, in your providence, why is it such that for a week when the expectation is that I talk to somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people over the course of 4 days and deliver a bunch of talks which require to be like energetic, I feel like I was just hit by a large bus. That falls within your providence, does it not? Your thoughts? Nothing. Okay, cool, great. Right, so like that. But I think that something that's beautiful about anger is that if, you know, one can say something in these terms and not fall afoul of the truth, just say it, Gregory. I think that it's a kind of childlike sentiment. It's a kind of childlike emotion. Because at the end of the day, when you're angry, you're just kind of stomping your foot and saying, nah, right? But I think that in being childlike, it can have a certain simplicity to it. It can have a kind of innocence. And I think that you're welcoming the other into the very space where you feel alone, like where you feel like you have not been seen, where you feel like you have been not, you know, you've not been loved, you've not been trusted. And it's so childlike to say the very person who made me experience this is the person whom I want to abide with me in this, because I have a hope that this relationship is indeed what I thought it was. And I have a hope that this relationship, as a result of whatever just happened, can be more than it was, which I think is a very childlike thing. Like, children just keep coming back to the people who hurt them. You know, it's like, 4-year-old is on the playground with a 6-year-old. The 6-year-old pushes him down. He cries, and then he runs back to him. It's just like, I mean, that's either a recipe for a life of trauma, or it's a genuine hope in the goodness of humanity. Like, it's a genuine hope in the goodness of the relationship. Okay, that's just my thought. Sending back.
Yep. Okay. Lots there. Okay. let me work kind of backwards to the initial one. On the notion of it's childlike to run to the person who harmed you. There seems to be like there's something analogous to that that happens when we run to God, when we don't, even if we think that it's God who has slighted us, and also knowing that it is not he who really has slighted us. Just to tweak on prepositions here, anger is at a person because of an offense, but it seems like what we do is when we don't know exactly how to understand the offense, we run to God. So running to someone looks really similar to running at the person, but there's still a qualitative difference to it. So that's just one thought on kind of the childlike simplicity of anger. It seems to me that what you mentioned about bringing the other into, bringing the other close, becoming vulnerable, seems to me like that is a pattern both for resolving pain and resolving the injustice, but it's a little different on each. If you're at Sikh with raging fever in the middle of the night, and you have a completely childlike disposition, it seems to me like something. This is something of the cry that comes out, not immediately why, but something like this. Tell me some reason why. Like, tell me something good that's closer to me than this pain. Or give me something that's good that's closer to me than this pain. In other words, bring to me something that will make this okay. If whatever has been taken from me, you know, good health, if that can't be restored, then show me something else that I already have so that I can rest in that rather than rest in the pain. That's what I mean when I say you want someone to be with you. And it ultimately, it's something like this. My God, I'm in pain. I don't understand it. I can't. I'm trying to get away from it, but I can't. So rather than trying to get away from it, I'm going to stop. I'm going to just say, be closer to me than this pain. Be the good that I already have. And let me rest in your presence rather than resting in this pain. And I think what is kind of sloppily being described here, you notice I just put that in the passive. what I'm trying to describe, I think, is something like grieving, I think. So grieving would be different from sorrow, although we tend to speak of them kind of as the same thing. It's not just I'm enduring grief. It's that grieving is a response to sorrow. And I think in order to go through the grieving process, you know, which indicates that there's some dynamism in it, there's a trajectory, that the process of grieving involves one, not running, like getting yourself in a position where you're not running from the pain, but then also without denying that the pain is still there, finding the good in which you can rest even more deeply than you are currently resting the pain.
I'm not going to permit you to get all your nest points, but just a response to that real quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
I suspect that many people have had the experience where they've been in a situation which could be objectively described as difficult. Maybe they were far away from home, like an immersion experience or something where they were out of their depth or beyond their comfort zone. And at the time, you know, you find it difficult and maybe it stretches you and maybe other things kind of come up that you hadn't known previously were difficulties for you. But because of this increased stress or anxiety, now it's bubbling to the surface. But like in the midst of that, you find ways in which to live or you find ways in which to persevere. And then you come back to quote unquote normal life. And then you miss something of the intimacy of what was formerly. It's like because you had the experience of precisely what you describe, that somebody gave you something, gave him or herself to you in a way that made it more near than in fact the pain itself was. But bizarrely, almost paradoxically, it required the pain in order to experience that intimacy because the pain clings so close, right? But it also affords you the opportunity to have something penetrate deeper, right? And then you just, like having been convicted of that, you're like, holy smokes, how can I go back to normal life? You know, like, you expect me to eat a Chipotle burrito? You know, it's like, what in the world? So, yeah, I think a lot of people have had that experience, and I think it is a kind of grief. And it's strange because, on the one hand, you're escaping a situation in which you were battered and bruised, but on the other hand, you experienced in that a kind of precious intimacy, you know?
Okay. Yeah, it's kind of like if you've been on the cross, and then you're told to go back to the wedding feast of Cana. Like, wait, is this a backstep? Well, no. But, yeah, there is a kind of pedagogy in suffering. And the newness of, you know, or what we learn when we are in great pain, it's not lost when the pain itself is removed, but it can feel a little more distant.
Yeah. It's like St. Catherine, after you're done kissing his feet and then drinking from his side, you just want the kisses of his lips. You know, it's like, you don't want to go back down the ranks.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah. Oh man.
Right. To injustice, can I get so my, the outline that's in my head and now in my hand, it's like offense is somehow composed or comprised, or there are two aspects of the pain. And then this sense of injustice seems to me like, an injustice, a perceived injustice, needs to be healed or needs to be resolved. And I'm thinking, okay, what are, okay. I said earlier, I was going to talk about dancing. Suppose we're going to do the cha-cha, right?
Sign me up.
Okay. So what is justice? Like, what are the laws, you know, the rules of the cha-cha? Okay, you put your hands in a certain way, you know, when I go back, when you go forward, when I go forward, you go back. And we could, suppose we were like just really beginners in ballroom dance, we would have to,
Suppose.
Theoretically speaking. This is a verbal demonstration, not a physical one. Okay, so if we're beginners, then we're clinging, as all beginners do, we're clinging to the only rules that we know. It's like one, two. So it's like we're probably even saying that out loud as we're doing it, right? Because the laws are new. So when the laws are new, those is like basically I'm focusing on the laws, you're focusing on the laws. In that case, an injustice, that's to say, an infraction of the law, is really obvious. So not just because, you know, you step on my foot or something like that, but because both of us are really, really mindful of the laws. Okay, suppose after a while, we get over, those really simple, obvious infractions in which it's almost like, okay, you can get miffed, but probably when you're both beginners, we're both constantly saying, oh, sorry, sorry, sorry. And as soon as someone says sorry, the anger is gone, right? Or like the impulse to get angry is really dissolved if you recognize that the person genuinely is sorry, right? So suppose we get pretty good, or suppose you get a lot better. So you've internalized not just the laws of cha-cha, but you get the feel of it. But suppose I am a little bit more of a legalist and kind of like a mechanic. I'm not as intuitive. intuitive, just in theory. And suppose, so we're out on the dance floor and you start to do something that's, it's still kind of within like the feel of the cha-cha, but it's breaking the laws that I have internalized. I get angry at you because what I am fixing my attention on are, let's call it kind of like the basic laws. Seems to me like in order for me to resolve that anger, what I need to see, probably through your instruction, but maybe not, maybe thinking through it, what I need to see is that there's some higher law that you are following. And therefore, the seeming, abrogation of, or breaking of this lower law, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me like what needs to happen for the healing of an offense, not just the grieving of a pain, but also what I call kind of the subsuming of a lower law underneath a higher law. And that needs to happen in me. And it ideally, in the course of a friendship, happens also with someone else. So it's a much better thing for me on the dance floor to say, yeah, Father, what are you doing? Right? You're breaking this law. And then you could say, well, yeah, if that was all dancing was you doing these steps and me doing this steps, then it would be a breaking of a law, but there's a higher law. And it's this, you know, the higher law is we move together, you know, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's like, you're not only, I take my anger to you and at you, even though I don't yet know exactly what was wrong.
Yeah.
I can't see it. So I take my anger to you, even though it's also kind of at you. And then with your ability to perceive not only my pain, but also you can see the littleness of my judgments and then help point to the higher law.
So I think let's take this back to the example of the toilet paper roll exhaustion and then put it in conversation with wisdom learned in the novitiate. Something that our novice master said to us, he said, give each other permission to change. Because, you know, like you spend all your time together in the novitiate, you learn a lot about each other. You learn each other's strengths and weaknesses. There's a whole canon of stories. And in some of those stories, you're the hero. In some of those stories, you're the villain. But we can characterize each other, not so much as like true to form, but as kind of tropes. You know, he's the one that does these things and he's the one that does those things. But he encouraged us, he said, you know, give each other permission to change. And in a certain sense, expect of each other that change. So like in the case where the one individual accuses the other individual of having exhausted the toilet paper and not refilled it, the one who has been accused is offended because he hasn't been given permission to change. Right? There's like a higher law. And the higher law is that I can learn, I can grow, and I also expect that you can rely upon me to learn and to grow. Will I be slow in certain instances? Sure. Might I backslide in certain instances? Absolutely. But there should be a kind of upward trajectory in our relationship. You know, not to say that we're just like, we're here to improve each other, because then that becomes artificial and hokey. But I think that like in the example that you cite, you know, like it's then for, you know, like when you confront me with your anger, it would be destructive of the relationship if I were patronizing and condescending and said, like, well, if you but knew the higher laws of dance, relationship over. It's like, oh, yeah, I totally get that. I'm sorry. You know, I should have been more clear. You know, like, or I was thinking along these lines. Maybe it's right. Maybe it's not. At this point, I'm going largely by intuition. You know, as a theologian, I'm just saying things and hoping they're true. You know, wow, this just cleaves to real life. Right, but I should be able to recognize that instantly, right? Because even while I'm operating according to a, as you described, a higher law, I still can see the coherence and I can still see the logic of what makes you angry. You know, that's just still clear.
Yeah. The phrase that you've used several times is the friend holds another in mind and heart. What you just described as the condescending, let me show you the higher law. That seems like it would be ineffective and a new offense, not only because of the tone of voice, but also because that might be holding the other in mind, but it's not holding the other in heart. And if you were to just say, get over it, I'm following a higher law, that would be an obliviousness to the pain. And sounding kind of mushy, but I think it's important that Aquinas' notion of, or at least if we can broadly construe what we're saying as Thomas's notion of anger's healing capacity, and then also ultimately the capacity to heal anger, that this takes place both on the level of the judgments, so there's a rectification of judgments or kind of an upward trajectory of judgments, but then there's also the recognition of the pain. So if you showed yourself to be just, you know, cold-hearted and not red, but I don't know, green towards, you know, if there's a mismatch on the heart between the one who has offended and the one who has been offended, that also won't be a very healing exchange. And I think we could easily misunderstand Aquinas by saying, oh, well, all that needs to be healed is your judgments. Always, ever, only is your judgments. I don't think that's the case.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.